Birdsong, hugging, tea and biscuits. The feeling of calm which follows the realization that although you may be in a regrettable situation, there's nothing you can do about it.
Everyone, and welcome back to No Script, an unscripted conversation about theater's best scripts. I'm Jackson, that's Jacob, and we are back from a long stint, a whole month of themed month, episodes about mini month, short plays, 10-minute plays, etc. And it was a lovely journey, but we are back into the regular season of programming and into full-length scripts after that moment of themeness.
That's right. Yeah, we love 10-minute plays, loved to get to talk about them, but nice to be back in our regular season. I will say, though, we're not really coming, like, that far
back.
It's
true.
Like, we didn't decide to come back and do, like, a five-act, 1,000-character Shakespeare play, you know? It's like a soft return. Today's play is, it's a one-person show, sort of, and it
big,
is
sort
only
of.
Runs in... Yeah, big sort of. And it only runs about an hour is generally kind of how long this show runs. So a long one act, this is a really minimalist show. This is a highly imaginative show. This is an improvisational show. This is also a show that I think if you're out there, you are very likely to have seen or to have had the chance to see. Certainly, there's a great recorded version of this play online with the original performer, Johnny Donahue. And it's also just everywhere. As I'll talk about when I get to the context section, this play is really, really, really popular. It's not, you know, it doesn't have the name recognition of the big musicals that are out there. But for, like, a play without music, this play is pretty well known in communities because for a lot of reasons. I'm sure we'll talk about some. But it's exciting to get to talk about it because I've had some personal experiences with this play. And it's one of the more powerful pieces of theater I've ever seen. And I saw it in a well-lit classroom, like not even in a theater setting at all.
Oh, wow. That would definitely change it for sure. But yeah, I imagine it would like highlight some of the poignancy, some of the visceralness of this play. It's a great play. Great. I'm excited to get into some of the interestingness of it because, as you say, it's a one-person show, but is it really?
The answer to that is really no.
Yeah.
And it's just so unique. This play is like unlike other plays. This is the kind of play that to speak now of myself as an artist rather than just the podcast host who talks about plays, like this play is the closest to what I think theater needs to be headed towards.
Ooh, interesting.
As film gets so good at telling stories, theater has to figure out, I really think, like what it's going to be now. Because a lot of the function that theater served, not all of it, I'm a big proponent of theater. I'm at a university getting a theater degree.
Right.
I need a graduate degree in theater. I'm a big proponent of theater. But a lot of what theater was since the ancient Greeks and since long before that has been taken up, I think, adequately by film. But experiences like every brilliant thing are impossible, at least with the technology we have right now. To have in a other than just being in the room with other people and with an actor.
Yeah, I agree. The sort of communal effort of theater, the live conversation, the back and forth, and the ability to not just draw you in with plot and character, ethos and pathos and all the things, but also by participation is on full display in this script and excited to have the chance to chat about it and get to share it with all of you.
Yes, I've already given away the title, and of course you've seen the episode by now. Every Brilliant Thing is a play by Duncan MacMillan with Johnny Donahue. Duncan MacMillan is an English playwright and director. We've talked about him before on the podcast. We covered his play Lungs, which was fantastic, and also had some strange similarities to this play, which we may bring up at one time or another. Johnny Donahue was not quite the original performer. I'll talk about this in the context section, but was the original person who toured this full version of the show around, and because of how improvisational and audience interaction based the show is, Johnny Donahue's a comedian, so had those skills already. A lot of what's in the published version of the play is Johnny's material from live performance, as well as Duncan's like original writing for the play.
That's cool. Kind of the way that it builds off of each other. Okay, so excited to get into context and all the things and all of our conversation. Before we jump into that conversation, though, I want to take just a second and say thank you to all of our patrons over at patreon.com/NoScriptPodcast. Thank you all so much for being a part of making NoScript happen. We love getting to do this show. We love getting to have conversations. We love getting to have things like themed month last month and conversations about full-length plays, all sorts of plays. And the patrons at patreon.com/NoScriptPodcast make that happen. We love getting to do the show, and it is not a free endeavor, so thank you all so much for helping out. If you're looking for a way to get involved in the NoScript community, if you're looking for a way to help out the show, patreon.com is a great way to do that. You can sign up for a number of different tiers of patronship, the lowest one being just $1, $12 over the course of a year, there's a number of other tiers. You can find all the information over there, but you get access to lots of cool things like patron-only posts and advance notice of the scripts we're doing and things like that. So if you're a longtime listener or just a recent listener that is looking for a way to get into the show a little bit more, you can head on over to patreon.com/NoScriptPodcast. Thank you to all of the patrons who have already done so, and we will see you over there.
And now back to the script.
All right, here we go.
Okay, so the story of Every Brilliant Thing by Duncan MacMillan with Johnny Donahue is the story of an idea that sort of flourished into a worldwide phenomenon, which is amazing. The story goes that Duncan MacMillan owed an actor a favor. This actor had performed in a Duncan MacMillan play and had no lines and was like, you know, had to face away from the audience or some such thing. And so this actor, who was a woman, said to Duncan MacMillan, "You owe me this." And so he wrote her a monologue. This monologue was originally had kind of the core premise that Every Brilliant Thing had, a list of all the brilliant, wonderful things about the world. And this actor performed it as part of a festival, and it really took off, and she was asked to do it again and again and again in a couple of different venues, in a couple of different places. And eventually they realized that they had something. And so Duncan MacMillan himself rewrote it a little bit longer, took away the gender specificity of it so it could be performed by anybody, and came up with this slightly longer, more complete version that he called Sleeve Notes. That's going to be the title of this project for a long while. And some remnants of that you can see in Every Brilliant Thing. There's a focus on records and things written on the insides of records, even still in the fuller version of the play. Along with a group, so Duncan performs it himself, and then it gets a group of collaborators, and they decide, we're going to make this a bigger thing than it is. This has some power, this has some go, this has some juice, let's make it into a bigger thing. So they create a Facebook group in which they solicit items for the Every Brilliant Thing list from all over the world, and they get thousands and thousands and thousands of suggestions that are going to go into their Every Brilliant Thing list. And they realize from that what this, maybe they didn't realize, but they had a sense of what this could be with that kind of response. So they continue to make the play fuller and fuller. Eventually they take it to something called the Latitude Festival, not a festival I'm particularly familiar with. The story goes that they were performing Sleeve Notes inside of a tent. It's an installation art piece, basically. And they had it set up so that every cycle, this show was about 15 minutes or so at that point, somebody else, they had comedians, actors, directors, writers, would come in and perform it. So it'd be the same monologue story thing that they had on a 15-minute cycle with someone new performing it each time. And they did this all throughout the festival for 4 days straight. in 2012, they decide to fill it out into a full hour-long piece. They call it Every Brilliant Thing. Eventually, they get comedian Johnny Donahue to start touring it to be their kind of leading starring actor for this thing, to take it all over Europe and, you know, all over the world. They perform it over years and years. And eventually there's a published version of the script as it exists that gets released in 2015. That gets recorded. Johnny Donahue performing in Every Brilliant Thing gets recorded, turned into a great TV movie documentary sort of thing in 2016. And then it just, it's everywhere. And I'm just going to read, I'm going to try to focus on the more recent productions, as well as many that are happening this year. Yes, I said many. And so here's a nice list. So 2016 TV movie, 2017 Portland Center Stage. I'm just going to mention that because I like the PCS. 2019 Theater Squared, where I lived in Arkansas. Theater Squared did it. It was a big deal when it was there. Then here's a fun list. This is a small, small percentage of all the places that Every Brilliant Thing was, with different actors of different, you know, all over the world. And I'm going to try to focus on North America and recent. 2021 Siegel Center in Montreal. 2021 Jungle Theater in Minneapolis. 2022 Actors Theater of Louisville. 2022 Horizon Theater Company in Atlanta. 2022 Arden Theater in Philly. 23 Theater Alaska in Juneau. NC Stage Company. ACT Contemporary Theater in Seattle. Yale College Arts. Garden Theater in Florida. Harlequin Productions in Washington. Great Theater in Minnesota. Farmers Alley Theater in Kalamazoo, Michigan. An extended run at the in LA at the Geffen Playhouse. It was there and so popular that they extended the run by quite a bit. This was all just, that was like 2021 through 23. This year alone, January and February, it was at Playmakers Rep in North Carolina on tour. February through March of 2024, it was at the Arts Club in Vancouver. March, it was at the Dallas Theater Center. Currently on tour, starting in February, shows are booked through May. The Virginia Stage Company is touring it, and their advertisement says, back by popular demand. Which means at some point before they were doing it. Here, where I am in Montana, there was a statewide tour to more than 44 cities in 2019 with a couple of local actors that I know and love dearly. And the show was so popular back then, of course the pandemic happened, that it has gone back on tour and they are now performing it again. I saw it last year in 2023. It still got performances in 2024. The play is everywhere, in part because of its power, in part because of its ease of production, in part because of it's getting a reputation for the kind of show that it is. So that's a small glimpse at its life. I know I didn't talk about any of the European productions, and it started as a European play. I didn't really talk about anything about right when it came out, but there's just too much. This is like, this has the resume of a play that is like an Arthur Miller play from like the 50s. You know, it's like that long of a life. It's got a comparable resume.
Yeah. Wow, yeah. Yeah, big accolades for sure for it. I think it is well earned. Excited to jump into the conversation. I'm going to give you just like a flyby synopsis of this play, and then we'll kind of get into all the rich intricacies of it as we go. This play focuses on a character named Narrator. We never really get the actual name of Narrator, but it tracks his journey through much of life. And his, just by virtue of Johnny Donahue playing the role, there's a note at the beginning of the play that says doesn't have to be him playing the role. And
in fact, both times I've seen it, it was a female identifying person playing the role. So it was sort of strange to me to read it.
Ooh, interesting.
The script is written with male pronouns because of Johnny.
Yeah.
But it just, that was a strange sort of like flip in my brain.
Fascinating. So I'll be using the him pronouns in this one by virtue of the way the script is, or my script is written. But again, this can be cast with whatever gender is playing the role of narrator. Also, real quick at the beginning, as I'm about to synopsize this, it's worthwhile to just give a little bit of a content warning for what we're going into today. This is a play that centers around a list of every brilliant thing in the world that is worth living for. And it centers around some suicidal ideation issues, the journey of one of the characters of narrator's mother and her journey with depression and suicidal ideation. So If that doesn't sound like what you need to hear today, just a warning right away at the start. Come back another time and listen to it, or listen to one of our many other episodes. I'm excited about this conversation. It's a great play, but if that's not where you're at today, that's A-OK. Find another episode to listen to, and we'll catch you on another one. So with that said, I'm going to jump into the synopsis of this script. So, narrator is the compiler of this list of every brilliant thing worth living for in the world. It tracks his life from a time when he was very, very young all the way until he's, you know, I don't know, somewhere a little bit later in life, maybe 30s, maybe 40s. Hard to tell exactly where he lands by the end of the script. But the journey is the start of this list from, you know, the first seven things he writes on the list, all the way to the list being a million entries long. he goes through quite the journey of developing this list. The person that's sort of along or motivates a lot of it, though, is his mom. His mom goes through serious bouts of depression. The kind of instigating bad set of days for narrator is his dog dies. And then he's picked up at school by his dad, who says that his mom is in the hospital because she can't see anything worth living for, is what his dad tells him. When narrator gets to the hospital, his mom says she doesn't want him to come in and see her. So instead of seeing her, he sits down in the lobby and starts writing this list of every brilliant thing about the world, everything that is worth living for. Throughout his childhood, he leaves it strategically in places to try to help. As the list grows and grows and grows, he's trying to kind of give his mom something to live for. And there is this sort of like a relationship, contentious relationship with the list and his mom as he's writing it. He continues to write it all the way through high school, and eventually when he leaves for college, he stops writing it. And the list kind of winds up in a children's book of his. There's a number of other characters that we meet along the way. There's an old couple who helps in the lobby, etc. All those characters will come about when we get past the synopsis, because they're important for reasons yet to be described. But the next kind of like main character that we meet is Sam. And wait. Before that, we have one other character of great importance who is Mrs. Patterson, who helps him through as he's developing this list. Mrs. Patterson is kind of a school counselor who has this sock puppet therapist. he says it was the 80s, okay? Just roll with it. And this sock puppet therapist is kind of like helping him process his grief and the fact that he's making this list at all. Kind of helps him through the process of that. Back in college, college or post-college, somewhere in there, he meets Sam. And Sam is this woman who he meets with, and they begin to spark a romance between them. They trade books back and forth, and eventually, through the process of trading the books back and forth, he accidentally sort of gives her, pretty accidentally, gives her the book, the children's book that has the list of every brilliant thing in it, which she discovers. Eventually, she kind of like hints that he should read the book as well. And so he eventually does, and he opens up and discovers the list of every brilliant thing. He's like, oh my gosh, how embarrassing. I gave this to her. Oh, I forgot this. I completely forgot this existed. But then he discovers that Sam has added entries to the list of every brilliant thing. And so their relationship develops, trading back every brilliant, little brilliant things, things that are worth living for, on and on it goes. It tracks their relationship all the way through kind of moving in together, getting married, and then eventually moving out and the breakup of the relationship. The list sort of peters out somewhere in there, somewhere in the very large numbers. I don't have the exact number at that particular time, but we're in the hundreds of thousands of numbers of every brilliant thing at this point. To briefly sum up the rest of the script. Oh, I think Jacob has
it. For what it's worth, 826,978.
Long way through the list.
Look, the actual literal reality of the possibility of writing a million item list, and then later in the play, as you'll describe, the main character retypes the list for their father, is that it's just not an issue in the play. There's a part of your brain, at least in my brain, that goes like, I don't know, that's a lot. I mean, I think I've like watched, isn't there, there's like specials on like how long it would take to count to a million,
right?
Let alone write a million. But it's just so doesn't matter. Like, it's so, you just accept that that's what's going on.
Yep. So yeah, just hundreds of thousands of these delights that they, or delights, brilliant things that they have written together. Eventually, though, their relationship kind of falls apart, and Sam leaves. It turns out she leaves a note in a record. Records are an important part of this, of kind of the backstory. Narrator's dad listened to records a lot, and narrator loved to read the kind of cover label and the story of the record. So Sam leaves a note in one of the records.
Hence the original title, Sleeve Notes.
Yep. And so Sam leaves this note. He finds it 7 years later. Doesn't come across it very quickly, but it says essentially, if you ever are in a place that you want to kind of meet again, we should do that. And also, you should maybe get some help. And so he ends up calling Mrs. Patterson back all these years later and talks to the sock therapist once more. And manages to kind of process some of what's going on for him. And again, to just very briefly, we're jumping all the way to the end here. Eventually, his mom kind of ends her battle with depression. He finds out that she has finally committed suicide. And the kind of grief process that he then goes through with his dad, he goes to kind of be with his dad for a little while. After all this time, 7 or 8 years later, Sam reaches out and says, I think you should start the list again. I'm really sorry to hear about your mom. I think you should start the list again. Here's one to get you started. And so with that kind of cueing him forward, he manages to finish the list and leave it for his dad. That's very close to the end of the play. He gets a final note from his dad saying thank you and I love you. And he kind of ends the play with the millionth brilliant thing is a reason worth living for. Now, all of that happens throughout the script. Anything else you want to add in before we jump into?
Well, I didn't find it as clear in the script as when I've seen it in performance. So I was just wondering if you felt, having read the script, that this is the conclusion. It felt to me both times I've seen it that the conclusion of the play, when the character, the main character who doesn't have a name because it's just the name of the actor, when that person gives their dad the million item long list, the experience of the story that I had as an audience member with two different performers in two totally different contexts was that the father also probably was suffering from chronic long-term depression and needed that list in their sort of continued, you know, look for reasons to live. That it was meaningful to the father to be provided with a list of reasons to live, even though the whole show has been about the mother's reasons to live or feeling that there aren't any reasons to live. It becomes, it's not quite a twist, but it becomes a sort of reorienting thing at the end of the play to realize at the end that the father character also needed this kind of care and attention and probably wasn't getting it through the whole of the play. And so for me, the play actually ended up becoming more about people who need help, who don't ask for it, which is the father character in this play. Then it does become about the mother's story. The conclusion for me and the sort of teaching about suicide that often is accompanied around the play tends to be more towards that. But I was surprised when I read the script how little I thought that came through.
Yeah. I mean, it's a sort of a late revelation. I do think that you're right on there. The script is kind of dedicated. It's or in the front to for dad. So there is like a sort of like when you're thinking about the whole written script, there is a focus there. And I think it is poignant, certainly, that it ends with the father receiving the list and the father being able to say thank you and I love you as a result of it, which is something that the mother had a struggle figuring out a way to do. Though there are like little subtle ways that she interacts with the list, especially early on, that makes it clear that she's read it and at least appreciates it enough to edit it. I agree with that sort of focus, especially a late game focus there. Now,
and just so that we have a sense of like what kind of, like what is this list, I'll just read a couple of random items, like no particular order. I'm not going to give their numbers either, just to save time. Birdsong, hugging, tea and biscuits, the feeling of calm which follows the realization that although you may be in a regrettable situation, there's nothing you can do about it. Dreams of flying, being cooked for, waking up late with someone you love, badgers. So, wide variety of things. And the narrator character does say at some point that they were trying not to focus on material things. So while there are some of the items are material things, in general it was trying to focus more on experience, on relationships, on something that happens rather than an item.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And while we're on that too, before we get to kind of the pivot of this script, the amount of things that these brilliant things are written on is astounding. This play can be done quite kind of a stripped down version for sure, but there is also a way to do this play where the stage is just like covered with, you know, like napkins and book covers and all the things that this list has materialized on before he types it all up and like puts it in a document. There's one point where he tries to throw it all away and they're all in this like big box, and eventually he finds it again towards the end of the play. It turns out Sam has saved it from the trash and left it for him, and so he compiles the list from like just this assortment of stuff that all carry the, like, you know, the handwritten brilliant thing on them. And it's just like a delightful way for kind of props to like illuminate something, the magnitude of a thing. I imagine you wouldn't have to do all million of them, but like there's the opportunity there to have this like really impressive magnitude of brilliant things scattered about stage.
Yes, and it's often the case, I don't think in either production I saw, but I've seen many ads and videos where they're all on sticky notes, and the stage becomes like covered in bright yellow or bright pink sticky notes.
Oh,
well.
That's lovely. Yeah, and slowly evolves to something bright and brilliant. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, so the pivot of this whole thing is I just named, you know, maybe 7 or 8 characters, and there's only one actor in this show. The rest of the characters are all farmed or found from the audience. All of these characters are kind of, and they're not plants. They're not people who know what's going on. These are all audience members who arrive at the show, and through what seems like about a 30-minute or so kind of pre-show investigation by the actor playing narrator, they are given the delights with a number associated with them, or I'm sorry, the brilliant things with a number associated with them, or kind of like interviewed subtly by the actor and determined interiorly by the actor that you're gonna play Dad, you're gonna play Sam, you're gonna play all these other characters, and then sort of, I think, just surprised in the moment when they are suddenly thrust into the role of these various characters and have to sort of improv, but also sort of like get coached through improving full scenes with narrator. There's this really interesting sort of liveness about this play, with the audience having to kind of jump into all of those characters that I mentioned other than narrator themselves.
Yeah, and that, of course, is why so much of the experience of this play is improv, is conversation. There is a script, there's a public version of the script, and that contains the story, more or less. But it is in those interactions with the audience members who step in to play the characters that some of the delightful, unexpected, funny, touching things happen. The audience is very rarely asked to speak impromptu, to come up with things to say. They're either fed lines to repeat back, or in one great scene, the character, the actor, plays their own father and the audience member plays the actor's character.
Yeah.
And the audience member is just prompted to continue saying why, like a young child would do. And then the actor who's playing their own father does the whole thing while your mother's in the hospital because she's unhappy because of blah, blah, blah. And it goes on. There's like 3 pages of that.
Yeah.
Where the father's continually prompted by the word why. So there's not a lot of improvisation required, except for a wedding speech, which the actor who's been thrust to play the father is asked to give impromptu. And there's a great note from, I assume, Duncan McMillan in the script about how this is going to have a huge, there's almost no way to predict what the audience is going to say when they're asked to impromptu give a wedding speech, but that you should not be surprised if it comes out quite beautifully. And that at one point, there's a great story in the script about how they had picked someone who was a rabbi to play the father unbeknownst to them. And a rabbi, of course, being someone who's been at many weddings. And the rabbi stood up, and a rabbi also someone who's very comfortable speaking in front of the people, and stood up and gave an incredibly beautiful wedding speech.
Wow.
Which incorporated like the list that they had been building about how they had, you know, what they were looking for, reasons to live for.
Hmm.
I mean, there's a huge surprise. The audience is also asked to do some very surprising, uncomfortable things. You described the audience member who's asked to play the school counselor. This audience member is not asked to do much, except, I mean, in terms of lines, but what they are asked to do is take off their shoe,
yeah,
take their own sock off their foot, and put it on their hand as a sock puppet. I mean, truly.
Yep.
That is, I mean, you're supposed to do that. And, I mean, according to Duncan McMillan's notes in my copy of the script, and no point in their experience of the show has an audience member outright refused to do it. That it sometimes takes some prompting, but they always do it.
Yeah, yeah. I have such like curiosity around, and you having seen this play before, I have curiosity around like what the social contract is going into this show. I mean, at this point, you know, there is an awareness of this show when you go to see it. There is some awareness of, oh, I may be asked, I may be one of the people picked. But I wonder, especially early on, is there an awareness going in by the audience that, oh, this is a live fire that we're going into, and we may be asked to be brave in this space. And so like what the social contract is there.
You know, it probably is, it depends entirely on who's producing it and what they choose to tell the audience. I already had some knowledge of what the play was both times I saw it. So it's hard for me to imagine somebody who only knew the title and then that it was loosely about suicide. The advertisements all heavily lean on the list, of course, the list of wonderful things to live for. And, you know, it's often advertised as being both really funny and, you know, like, really genuine and honest about the hardships of life. And so I don't know exactly what you're expecting when you walk into this room. I think that Duncan McMillan and the whole team around it did a really good job building this. It's like a slow burn to get to the place where an audience member might legitimately be ready to deliver an impromptu wedding speech.
Yeah.
Or things like that. I mean, first of all, as you've already said, when you come in, you're given, and I guess a large audience, maybe not everybody would get one, but both times I saw it, almost everybody had one. You're given at least one of the items on the list on a sheet of paper or whatever, and you'll be asked to read it aloud at some point. So you're already like, this is going to be an audience participation show.
Sure, yeah.
In some sort or another. And then the first character that anyone's asked to play, as I recall, like, I might be wrong, but I think this is right, is the vet.
Yeah.
And the vet is an actor who all they have to do is come onto the stage. They're given some lines to say back, you know, whatever it is, like, I'm sorry about your dog. There's some more well-written stuff than that. But they're parroting back a couple of lines. And then they're given a pen from someone else in the audience, and they're supposed to pretend like they're putting the dog to sleep. The actor has taken someone's coat, and in a really beautiful moment, really touching, folded that coat over their arms like it's the dog. And the vet, you're supposed to act like you're killing a dog.
Yeah.
With a syringe of poison, you know, like they do. I mean, I know that's a harsh way to put it, but I'm just trying to describe the experience of it. I played the vet once. And here's what I'm setting up for. as you come up as the vet to do it, this is in the script, you put the syringe into the dog, which is just a pen into a coat, and the actor immediately goes, not there, here. And then the time that I did it, this is not in the script, so I assume this was the actor's choice. They did that to me about 3 or 4 more times. So there is moments like that, and then frankly the sock puppet thing too. I think get your comfortability with, I'm not expected to do things right. I'm probably going to be a little bit, you know, I might be a little self-conscious, but it's probably going to be funny. The actor takes a lot of the onus on themselves. You know, if they're going to ask you to do the sock puppet thing, there's not much else you have to contribute to that scene.
Yeah.
The actor does pretty much all the other work. So it's a build of participation over time until then, late in the play as well, the actor playing Sam gets down on their knees and proposes.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's all sorts of, like, great... There's.
Sorry, I said the actor playing Sam. The audience member playing Sam.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, there's all sorts of great moments. There's, like, there's even one... Oh, I'm trying to remember which exact character it is, but there is one where it kind of lands on whether or not he was this. It was it's Mrs. Patterson in the sock puppet, the reprise of their conversation. He asked the question of whether he was, like, kind of this sad when he was a kid or not, and there is the opportunity for like one way or the other to go, and the actor has to, like, kind of move through whatever Mrs. Patterson or the sock puppet ends up telling him he was, like, no, you were really happy when you were a kid, or no, you were, I mean, yes, you carried some of this sadness with you even when you were a little kid. So there is, like, I agree that there's, like, baby steps at first, and but yet over the course of the whole thing, there's some real big collaboration that the audience members are invited into to have the chance to have some, you know, some effect over the story.
And just I want to read that section that you mentioned, because I think it's really interesting. So they're on the phone with the narrator. The actor is on the phone with the school counselor audience member again. They say, I wanted to ask you, was I always like this? Do you remember what I was like? And the audience member either says yes or no. And then the actor says, was I happy? And then the stage direction says, the narrator leads the sock puppet through a brief conversation until a conclusion is reached that allows the narrator to take the next step. Either he's always been sad or he was once happy. And then the actor comes back, thank you, it means a lot to hear that from you. So an impromptu conversation is called for that requires the skill of the actor and the willing participation of the audience member to move through something. There's a lot of reasons why this play does that, probably. I don't know that we'll be able to touch on all of what's going on. The theatricality of it is incredible. I mean,
yeah.
It's an experience that is totally unique. It's something like being at a stand-up comedy show and knowing that at any point the shirt you're wearing could become the next punchline of the joke. It's something like that. It's something like being at a play where there's a fictional story that has some broader truth that you know you're trying to communicate. It's something like being at an improv show. It's something like being at a bar and having somebody stand up and tell a story. It's something like all that. It's beautiful. It's something that you can only get by being in the room. But it's also a play about being willing to have conversations about suicide and the importance of, and this is why the play to me so much ends up being about the father, because all throughout the play, the father has this routine and it's never really examined, but it becomes the backdrop of the play. When the father is in the middle of intense emotional distress, he goes into his office and closes his door and is by himself. And that is just, again, it's not examined or commentated on or criticized. It's just part of the fabric of the life and the characters of the play. Until you get to the end, when the actor character provides that list to their father and it is so meaningfully received, you see that bid for connection has been so valuable. And so because the play is about being willing to have conversations about suicide, being willing to reach out to your friends and your loved ones and say, how are you doing? What's, you know, let's talk. What's going on? Being willing to suggest that someone goes to see a therapist. Because that's what the play is about to me at its core. If the play is just going to be an actor standing up and talking at you, there's no participation required in that. The form and the content don't match. This play, the audience has to participate in a play about participating.
No, it definitely like breaks down a barrier of connection. To have that initial bar set of like, you will be participating. We're not going to get through this unless you participate. And so it like kind of removes that barrier of, I could just like, maybe I'll just get away with like just listening from afar this time. And encourages, engagement with a really difficult theme that, you know, the undercurrent of this whole, you know, you have this list that is full of awesome things, and that's being generated during, you know, a big chunk of the play by two people who love each other and are kind of generating this list based off their love. But the undercurrent is all, you know, that he's making this list for his mom, and then eventually gives it to his dad, both of whom are really going through it, going through large bouts of depression. And there is this still underneath the joy and the kind of sparks of this list of brilliant things is a child who is giving a list to his mom, to try to help her find a way to keep going on. So yeah, it is a play filled with those kind of poignant connections and a sort of, firm resistance to allowing you to walk away from it. Like, let me hold you and we'll go through this together. Sort of mentality to it.
I also think that the play has a viewpoint, right? So if you're going to write a play like this, like who's the story going to be about? This story is, to be really honest, not about the person in the middle of suicidal ideation. This narrator goes through depression, real depression that they go to a support group as the result of. But it's also the facts and the realities of what it is like for the family around a suicide. That is really more what this play is about. And so real facts and statistics and advice are part of this play. At one point, the narrator just simply says to the audience, here's what the facts say about children of parents who are depressive or in the midst of suicidal ideation. Not in a way to blame or put judgment on at all, but just to say, this is the reality of this. And if we pretend like it's not, there's real damage in that. At one point, the narrator says, here's the advice, I forget the organization that they're quoting, but here is the advice from yada yada organization about how news outlets should report about suicides, because they're also describing how there is this phenomenon where after a national news story comes out about a particularly popularly discussed suicide of someone famous or in a particular way, whatever, there you often see a spike in suicides amongst other people. So what is our, right, the conversation becomes, what is our societal obligation around things like that? It's also about, here's a complicated part of the story of this play. This is a play about a list of reasons to live that is given by a child to their mother who does not live.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? I mean, this play is not, there's no neat bow on the end of this play about suicide. The mother dies by suicide at the end of this play.
Yep. Yeah, and you're foreshadowed and bookended very well, like all the way through with this, like the play starts with the line, the list began after her first attempt. And then there are these like progression marks through it of second attempt and then eventually a last. That it doesn't flinch. It doesn't flinch from that reality. And yeah, it does. And I'm reading other things about writing in general, and like the prompt to use, not use, but like present moments of pain means that if you choose as a writer to present moments of pain, there will be people who have been longing to feel not alone in that pain in community in some way. And I think that this play certainly does that of kind of bringing to light something that isn't talked about all that often, certainly not in a large communal setting, certainly not in a live theater improv participatory way, and really brings it into the communal sphere. I think all the way back to your comment towards the beginning of the episode, Jacob, in a way that is truly unique. That is truly theater's space, and thus can kind of have that sense of not alone, and even, you know, open the door to things like communal involvement in it, to healing, to processing, to all those things in a really unique way.
As you can imagine, the play is often presented, and I would even say probably responsibly presented, alongside counseling resources, alongside, you know, lobby setups with the grief hotlines, with sticky notes so you can write your own list of every brilliant things, with presentations, with panels. I mean, mental health resourcing and education often accompany this play. But the reason why you still want to have the play is, I think, what you described. It's that not alone, that human connection. I mean, part of what this play does is ask the audience to look around the room. And I don't mean that in a metaphorical way. Like, if you see a Broadway show, there's also 1,200, 2,000 other people in the room with you, and you might look around and be like, oh, look at all these people that are here. I mean, very literally in this play, the actor goes and sits with people in the audience and has conversations with them as part of the play, where they play character. You literally are forced to look around you, and also because every time an item on the list comes up, somebody from somewhere in theater is saying it. So that community, that being together in something that's hard and funny and can make you cry and also, you know, has some like really ridiculous slapstick jokes in it, you know, it's almost as much about that as it is about anything else. And the idea that you can be comfortable having this conversation, I promise. Right? It's not as bad as it seems. That's to me, that like that might be the if you tried to like write out what this play is about into one sentence, it might be like, having conversations about depression and suicide with your loved ones is not as bad as it seems.
Mm-hmm.
And the play tries to do that, right? I mean, so it puts audience members in situations where they're going to have those conversations, but it doesn't ask a lot of them. It makes them laugh. They make mistakes because the premise of the play is that they're going to make mistakes in the conversation, and the actor just rolls on through. I mean, it's almost more about you in the audience than anything else. And that's so powerful. I mean, I love movies. A film is, I think, always, and filmmakers out there are going to be annoyed with me, but I think a film is almost always going to be about the story of the film. It's a storytelling medium to me, film. And theater is too, but theater is also an experiential medium.
Yeah.
It's as much about being an audience member in the room with the story as it is about the story itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what happens inside of you as a result of being in the room with this story. So we're coming down towards the end of our time for this particular conversation. This is just a great show. I didn't know that you had seen it. It's so cool that you had actually gone and seen it. I'm excited to find a way to go and see it somewhere.
So I'm torn on what to recommend, honestly. I haven't seen the film. I've seen clips of the film production with Donahue. And so without seeing it, first of all, I'm always reluctant to recommend. But you can get it on Amazon. You can rent it for like $4 or whatever. You've got HBO Max. And so I'm sure it's great. Johnny Donahue is great. The clips I've seen are awesome. But, man, how much of the show do you miss? Or does get kind of spoiled for you by not actually being in the room with
it? Right.
Like, what? I don't know because I haven't seen it, so I'm speaking from ignorance. But I don't know what the experience of watching a recording of this kind of live, you know, intensely live thing would be. So I don't know whether I'm recommending it or not, other than I probably will watch it, especially because I've seen it a couple times live, so I already kind of have that built in. But I don't know. That's an interesting one to me. But it is out there if you want to watch the recording.
Yeah, out there to see it. Out there, certainly from the list of productions that you listed as well, there's plenty of stage productions going on as well. So if you go see it, or if you engage it in any way, whether reading it, watching it, or attending it in person, we would love to continue the conversation about it with you. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter at the username at NoScriptPodcast. We also have a Gmail, NoScriptPodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on any of those sites. We would love to keep talking about every brilliant thing with you.
If you've liked this conversation or any of our other conversations, please recommend us to your family, your friends, anybody you know that likes theater, stories, themes, writing, conversations about books, about stories, about all that kind of crazy nerd stuff. That's us. Send them our way. We are here on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, YouTube, Podbean, SoundCloud, all the places you get your podcasts. That's where we are. Check us out. You can also like our Facebook page, where a link to the new episode appears every Monday when we publish, including next Monday, when we're back with another great script. Until then, I'm Jacob. That's Jackson. Thanks for joining us for No Script, the podcast.